Thanksgiving, on a holiday more likely to be celebrated in Milwaukee than Mexico, on Cinco de Mayo, it's The Conversation. Today, the ABCs of Hepatitis Awareness Month, Hawaii's viral hepatitis coordinator gets us current with the impact of the disease on our state. And there's some better news coming from Kauai marine biologist Terry Lilly. He's got an update on the state of the reef.
Still on Kauai, how heavy is the code of honor? Dennis McGraw considers the answers in A Few Good Men. Meanwhile, on Maui, preparations are underway to celebrate All Things Portuguese. We'll get a historical primer. I'm Chris Vandercook. The conversation starts now. Next, the news.
A lot of drinking this past weekend. That music certainly gives you an indication. A lot of early celebrations of Cinco de Mayo. If that was you, we hope your Monday morning is happy and well. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. That was festive, wasn't it?
It was very festive, and certainly there'll be a lot more festivities later on today. But for the moment, we're going to have some conversation. Now, let's start with this statistic. 75% of American adults with hepatitis C are baby boomers. There's no vaccine to prevent infection, though treatments do cure some people. In Hawaii, it's hepatitis B that more often gets the spotlight. The infection rate among Asians, Native Hawaiians, and other Pacific Islanders tends to be higher, with 1 in 10 Asian Americans chronically infected with Hep B compared to 1 in 1,000 people in the general population. And why are we talking about all this? Well, May is Hepatitis Awareness Month. Thaddeus Pham is the state's viral hepatitis coordinator. He joins us now with an update of the effect on our state. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, and considering our state's population that tends to be quite long-lived, and we've got lots of people who are in that baby boomer generation, this is news that a lot of people need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I think so. Recently we did some looking at the numbers, and 1 out of 4 people in Hawaii are baby boomers. So, you know, there's all these new recommendations and new discussion about keeping our baby boomers healthy. And I think one of the things they can do is really talk to their doctors and get tested for hepatitis C.
For baby boomers in particular, you know, who sometimes think that they are invincible, you know, that stat of 1 in 4 who is a baby boomer in Hawaii, does that present some real challenges for you to get through to this population that they really do need to go ask a doc to get tested?
Yeah, you know, it can present some challenges. And I think sometimes it's just that a lot of people are unaware of that this is even happening. As you mentioned, 75% of those who have Hep C are baby boomers, but unfortunately, most of them don't know it. And it's a really simple, easy test. They can ask for it themselves with their doctors and just make sure that they're okay so they don't have to deal with liver cancer or liver disease later. So I'm hoping that maybe people who are listening, family members of people who are baby boomers, maybe they can be the advocates for their loved ones and encourage them to get tested.
Yeah, go talk to your parents.
Yeah.
That'll be a fun conversation.
Oh, yeah.
You hear some of those conversations and you try to talk to people when you're out at senior fairs. Mm-hmm. Do they look at you and give you the eye roll?
You know, once they know that we're trying to help them and that we're trying to maintain their health, I think they're very receptive to it. But what usually happens is they express a lot of surprise. They've never even heard of hepatitis C, or they think it's spread through something else, like drinking out of a cup that they shared with someone. But really, it's something that really can affect their community and that age group, anyone born from 1945 to 1965, regardless of anything they think they might have done or not done. So,
because you're talking about an exchange of bodily fluids.
And primarily blood. So, but, you know, even if they don't remember exchanging anything in the past, what we found is just being born in that time between 1945 and 1965 puts them at risk for having Hep C.
for Hep B, just for a moment, just to switch gears a little bit, because it so dramatically affects Pacific Islanders, Native Hawaiians, Asians, do you have any particular advice for trying to talk to elders who are also in that age group?
You know, we really encourage people to take care of their families. So just like we were talking about earlier with baby boomers, having family members talk to their elders, to their kupuna, in their own language, in their own cultural context, I think really helps them realize that that it's something that's important within their own community.
Because this can go, you know, beyond just the baby boomer group. It could be somebody who's been chronically suffering from something for a while but hasn't said anything and won't say anything because they just don't want to complain.
Exactly. You know, and especially in the Asian Pacific Islander community, sometimes there's a lot of cultural barriers that come into play. And, you know, there can be stigma, there can be some shame around hepatitis B. But really, if we open the conversation and encourage people to talk about it within their own families, in their own communities, I think we can make a difference, and I think we can really save people's lives, especially because it is impacting people in Hawaii, people that we know and love. So really raise your voice, talk about it, and don't be afraid to start a discussion like we're doing today.
Even if you get, you know, maybe slapped down in the beginning, try again. I want to talk to you a little bit about public policy around hepatitis, though, because given how it's changed, and especially in Hawaii, do you think that we're going to see mandatory testing just as part of the run-of-the-mill testing that you have done when you have your blood work drawn?
You know, it's hard to say right now. I know that in New York, they mandated Hep C testing for baby boomers statewide. You know, it's really, I can't predict the future in terms of what's going to happen here. But I think we can make efforts in terms of talking to our own providers and encourage them to remind people to get tested, and also encouraging, like we said, the people who are affected to ask for the test themselves, to empower people to take their health into their own hands.
Would it be easier if we had a public policy that said if you're born between these years, then automatically you're going to be screened for Hep C?
It could be. You know what? It depends. We're waiting to see what's happening in New York, because what's happened there now is they have mandated it, but there's no teeth behind it, in a sense. So they can say that you're supposed to do it, but there's no follow-up. So we're going to see if it does increase testing, or if it's just, you know, another piece of legislature that's kind of sitting on the books.
Yeah, that looks good, but doesn't necessarily translate into better results, even though the policy may be there.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting to see, and especially with healthcare transformation and all the changes that are happening, I think there could be a lot of great benefit to not only hepatitis, but a lot of other diseases that that are impacting our communities.
For hepatitis, and as you bring up the fact that we are going through such a tremendous period of change in healthcare, is that also easier for, or making it easier for people to get treatment?
You know, definitely. With more people getting insured and being covered, it makes it much more easy and available for people to access treatment, to access testing even. And that's why we really want to remind people, now that hopefully more people are insured, that they can get the resources they need to take care of themselves, especially for hepatitis.
And B and C, because for hepatitis A, that's a little bit of a different situation. But for B and C, there's no vaccine, and but there are some treatments that do some sizable good.
Right, yeah. Luckily, there's a vaccine for Hep B now, but for Hep C, there is no vaccine. And just as a reminder, we have the highest rate of liver cancer in the entire country. And the leading cause for us in Hawaii is hepatitis B and C. So it is impacting our community.
Well, we wish you a lot of good luck as it's Hepatitis Awareness Month. You're going to be busy.
Yes, we will. You'll hear a lot more from me probably.
Thank you, Thaddeus, for coming in. Thaddeus Pham is the Viral Hepatitis Prevention Coordinator at the state of Hawaii, in the state of Hawaii. It's his job to coordinate hepatitis services statewide by increasing awareness and access to care.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:13. Coming up, peer pressures, honor codes. They're the stuff of powerful drama. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking back at the work of a 19th century poet and songwriter. She was the author of these lines: "May gentle peace forever reign o'er these fair islands of the main, Hawaii's peaks to Niihau strand, the peace of God o'er all the land." These were the lyrics to the song Hamele Lahui Hawaii, believed to be the first of its author's published songs, and may have been the first song whose sheet music was published in Hawaii. The lines were written in Hawaiian and translated by H.L. Sheldon. The song was the first anthem of the kingdom, written at the request of Kamehameha V and published in 1867. A newspaper referred to the author saying, "This young Ali'i has thus received the fruits of her labors, and we hope that there will be more of her compositions hereafter." There soon were, and we're looking for this prolific songwriter's name. We're betting you know this one, so post it on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We'll be back with the answer in the next half hour.
Ciao, I'm Ben Soda from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue this conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
Is there true honor to be had in a so-called code of honor? Can such a code lead us into dishonorable acts? Where does a moral code end and peer pressure begin? Weighty questions all raised in the play A Few Good Men, the season-ending production for the Kauai Community Players. It's a play where the dialogue can cut like a knife, and it's a challenge for the director to manage all that intensity. Dennis McGraw has been there before, and he's on the line to talk about the show. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, the last time we talked, it was an Oscar Wilde play, right?
And this is about as different as you can get, yes.
But, you know, I found myself thinking about the similarities, if you'll humor me a second, because they both playwrights, Aaron Sorkin and Oscar Wilde, had a very good ear for the way people talked in their time, correct?
Wonderful conversational writing, yeah. Just a way with words, both of them. All agree with that completely.
And a need also for you as a director to keep the language very distinct and to keep it moving along, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Both plays are very wordy, but wordy in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the difficulty in the language in earnest, as opposed to the rapid fire kind of, in some of the trial sequences, rapid fire attack that is needed in some of this dialogue.
Yeah.
To bring out the intensity, yeah.
Well, you also, you can't be rapid fire all the way through the play,
oh,
right?
Oh, no, not at all. There's a lot of subtlety written in it, and it's just very, very good writing. There's a lot of humor, too. He seems to, the character, Daniel Caffey, which in the movie was played by Tom Cruise, it's got a lot of one-liners that are very, very funny.
The defense attorney.
But he throws them in at the exact perfect places to move, you know, to move it from one beat to the next beat, or where there's a tension, and they'll throw in one of these one-liners, and it really works very, very well. You know, the other thing, the thing that I like to see is the journey in the play of the character Daniel Caffey, who is a young lawyer, went to Harvard, and whose father was a very famous trial lawyer.
Uh-huh.
And he got into Harvard probably through his father and has been serving his 3 years in the Navy and has never gone to trial.
Yeah.
Every case that he's had, he's settled by a plea bargain. And these other two lawyers that are involved in the case have been convinced of that, no, not only you have to take this case to trial and you will be a great trial lawyer. He doesn't believe it. He's afraid. He's afraid he's going to fail in the shadow of his father.
Previously, he's been more of a deal maker and a pretty slick deal maker.
Exactly. He's at one point the female lawyer calls him a used car salesman.
That's right. Yeah.
and she said, "But you're the only one who can do this. We're not good enough. You're the one. You're the one who can convince them. That's your talent, and he has to be convinced that it is his talent." It's a fabulous the penultimate scene. Everyone knows that scene. Yeah.
Well, it's him as a person coming into his own,
mm-hmm.
right? Getting beyond the superficial.
It's him as a young man evolving in realizing that, yes, I can do this, gaining the confidence. There's a total evolution of character for him through the thing. You know, he starts out being not very serious about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And by the end, he's very serious.
Well, there's one, you know, when you get good at being slick, as this character is from the beginning, you know, mm-hmm. There's a tendency to kind of skate along the surfaces of life. And
exactly. And that's kind of what he does until mm-hmm. these other two lawyers don't let him do it anymore.
Well, that's which is a lesson that sort of goes way beyond the whole trial scene and the specific drama of the play, doesn't it? That could apply
very
to anybody.
Very much so, yeah. You know, the other interesting point is that the one line that the lawyer has, he says, the cover-up isn't our case. We simply have to convince the colonel to admit that he admitted this to Code Red. But really, the cover-up is the entire case. How high did it go?
Yeah.
This man was about to be made the head of the National Security Council, which is maybe the third most powerful person in the country as far as foreign affairs go, behind the president and the secretary of state. Someone wanted him to get this job very badly.
Well, just to sort of set the stage for this, the whole controversy here is essentially the, does one, in obedience to a code of honor, an internal code of honor, does one essentially cover up a crime, right?
Exactly. That's the internal conflict of the whole thing. And, you know, basically just right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the whole issue, as the issue bumps higher up to the highest levels, does the organization, does the institution as a whole routinely cover up crime?
That all is on the surface or slightly under it in this play, and I think mm-hmm. that's part of the reason he wrote it, to bring those questions out and let people speculate. Well, in real life, is this happening?
Well, we should probably sort of remind everyone, Dennis, that this is a very entertaining drama. It's not a.
Oh, it is. It's very entertaining. Yeah,
but it does. That's part of what makes it entertaining, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. The questions that are being asked, it's a very cutting edge, even though it was written, 1989, mm-hmm. I believe it was. It's still very, very fresh.
Yeah. One of the things that Aaron Sorkin and subsequently through his television programs has become really famous for is having very quick-witted, very intelligent, highly verbal people, right? With a great mm-hmm. deal of. So, how do you get the actors sort of in to convey that?
Well, first of all, I'm blessed in that I have a bunch of pretty strong actors.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of the young men in the play are men that are men that when they were younger worked with me as students in the Quad Performing Arts Center.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very lucky that a bunch of them will move back at the same time. So I think they all have a pretty good concept of what the play is as far as the intensity. And it's just a matter of rehearsal to get it, and I point out subtleties to them, but I haven't had to over-direct it. I hate to use the word over-direct, but direct a lot. The actors were good enough that they, with rehearsal, seemed to get the tenor of what we're looking for. I haven't had to do a whole lot. The actors are pretty strong in that net.
The hardest part has been
trying to figure out how to stage it.
Uh-huh.
Because it jumps all over the place. It jumps 50 times in the course of the play.
Really?
And we have a small theater.
So what? You've got you got exteriors? You've got barracks, courtroom?
Basically very minimal. We have little pools of light popping around in different areas on the stage for offices and for the brig and things like that. And, of course, the courtroom scenes, we transfer the entire stage.
Yeah.
So it was a challenge to figure it out, but we've done it.
Great.
So I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be pretty powerful, I think.
I would imagine. In terms of working with the actors, Dennis, what would be an example of the kind of note that you might give in a rehearsal?
I might just say, take a beat here. Mm-hmm. Just little subtle things.
Pacing kind of things.
Watch your pacing. Take a beat here because you want to make sure that that this sticks in things like that. To get more specific than that right now is hard, but those are the type of notes I give, just little things.
Well, that makes a lot of sense because it's those little adjustments that really gives it the overall rhythm, doesn't it?
Right now what I've been working on is trying to get more of a relationship of more of a, to be lack of a better word, a sexual attraction between the lead character and the lead female character, which at first they hate each other, but it evolves.
It's got to go that way, doesn't it?
Dennis, it becomes romantic, but it definitely changes from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, that gives it a lot of life.
There does have to be some sexual energy, and that's what we're working on now, having that develop as the play moves on.
Well, Dennis, you can do it. It's good to talk to you.
Dennis
McGraw is the director of the Department of Education's Drama Program at the Kauai Performing Arts Center and the director of the new Kauai Community Players production of A Few Good Men. It opens this Friday, runs for the next 3 weekends at the Puhi Theatrical Warehouse, and details are at hpr2.org.
Find it on a map, but it's still home.
When the GDR disappeared, I, for the first time, felt touched by this country because it was so quickly gone.
Author Maxim Leo was born in communist East Germany, a place alive in his heart and in his complicated family's hearts even today. Red Love, a Family Story, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
HPR continues to thrive thanks to the support of our members and our community partners who donated thank you gifts, provided meals, and answered phones during Challenge 2014. Thank you to the University of Hawaii Professional Assembly, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and to the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations for your participation and generosity of spirit.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, is being a vegetarian just a good idea for everybody?
Well, we're going to talk about that. You know, when we think about the main causes of death in the United States, cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, and strokes, one of the risk factors of having that is certain things in the diet. So we're going to talk about that because it may not be for everybody, but limiting your sources of animal proteins may actually have statistically been proven to reduce those risks long term.
Can you get all the protein you need without animal protein?
You can, actually. We're going to talk about how. Because some people think if you don't eat animal protein, it's all tofu. And it really isn't. So we're going to discuss some alternative sources. And then for people who don't feel they want to be vegetarian per se, but they want to limit some of their choices of meat, we'll talk about how do you find the healthy ones. So to sort of find an in-between realistic diet for just about everybody.
A lot of people fear blandness in their diet. With the vegetarian diet, that's an objection that you hear.
Sure, and you know, there's other things people say, I don't feel full, I crave meat, I need protein. And really, it all has to do with the fact that if you're not quite sure what sort of ingredients you can use or what sort of herbal different flavorings that are available out there, you're going to be more likely to think that it is bland or that it isn't filling enough. And we'll sort of dispel some of those myths today.
Because you might have to learn a few culinary skills in order to keep it keep things interesting in a sudden switch to a vegetarian diet. Yeah,
you might, you know, or you find out that there's great places in town that have very delicious vegetarian food, and if you're not somebody who likes to cook, there's excellent options for takeout as well. So we'll kind of cover all the bases for those who like the kitchen and those who don't.
I'm tempted to say can't hurt, Kathy, right? Because there aren't too many downsides from switching to a full vegetarian diet, are there?
There really aren't, you know, except for certain medical conditions where somebody might be anemic and need to have an extra level of iron. Other than that, you know, there really hasn't ever been proven to be a major risk of being a vegetarian. There's no studies that say this could hurt you because we just don't see that's the case.
Well, we might get some people interested, and they can certainly call in with questions, too.
As every week. You got it.
Terrific, Kathy. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, and that's tonight at 5.
Support for The Conversation comes from Friends of Waikiki Aquarium, announcing the Kekani Oke Kai Summer Concert Series with Kuana Torres Kahele, Cyril Pahinui, Makana, and more under the stars at Waikiki Aquarium beginning June 12th. WaikikiAquarium.org.
Nice to have a little relaxing music because you probably feel pretty strongly about this next conversation. Now, we've long been told that life is a series of trade-offs, but this one, according to several groups, may be more than just money for a few eyesores posted on buses. It's just not the potential bus signage, but also the control of the content that has the group saying, let's not go there. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair takes a look in today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I thought we had this conversation a while ago, and it seems as if it's resurging yet again. What happened?
That's correct. The Honolulu City Council did shoot down Mayor Caldwell's idea not long ago to put advertising on city buses to raise revenue, in part to sustain the bus system. But the council and the mayor do have to balance the budget by next month, and the temptation is that $8 million could be generated by having advertising on buses. So the council is revisiting the idea, but as you say, it raises all sorts of questions, and Sophie Koch has a very detailed story about some of the potential repercussions should we allow advertising on buses.
First of all, let's talk about that $8 million. There is some real question whether that is an amount of revenue that can truly be generated by putting signage on buses.
That's right. And we checked with comparable West Coast cities, San Diego, Portland, Oregon, so forth. And the figure in terms of their advertising revenue, much smaller, several million dollars in some cases. The challenge there is that you have to pay a vendor to handle the advertising cost, and that can be quite exorbitant. So that $8 million may be a bit optimistic.
Now let's talk about the ads themselves and what kind of control, because that seems to be where a lot of this argument is turning,
right?
That once you have an ad up there, that sort of opens up all kinds of issues of free speech.
Well, remember, we actually do have advertising on the interior of buses, and they are controlled. It's a, you know, you can't promote race and religion and violence and illegal or moral acts. And thus far, the bus system, the city has been able to control that. There doesn't appear to have been too many controversial issues. But to have them on the outside of buses, you know, think about it. The Outdoor Circle, thanks to them, we haven't had billboards in Hawaii since the 1920s. And a lot of people feel that that's a very good thing. Well, if you put an advertisement on a bus, that's essentially a moving billboard for a lot of people to see. And there's where the concerns come in to play.
Is it the same thing, though, when you have moving, you know, we have trucks, for example, that have signage all over them that promote
absolutely
a product or promotes a place of business. And we kind of just look at that and we're in traffic and off we go, most of us. It's not like a city bus, though.
We're talking about First Amendment rights. What if a group wants to promote an issue, abortion, religion, drugs, whatever the case may be, divisive issues? Can you turn them down? Can you censor them? Or are you violating their First Amendment rights? And I can tell you in other communities, it has been a challenge. Portland, Oregon, for example, which did run advertising on his transit system.
The
there
civilized
were ads
equating, man. You're talking about the
correct.
Civilized man campaign.
Ads equating Israel's enemies with savages. Very controversial, but long story short, that campaign was canceled. So that is a very serious concern, because there is a fundamental issue. But can you control that? Are buses, in fact, maybe limited public forums, something that can be regulated, if you will?
And as you mentioned, there are also those shock ads, things that would be very, very disturbing if they were seen by, well, just anybody, perhaps, but certainly young people.
Right, Honolulu residents may remember some time ago a truck going around town with pictures of aborted fetuses. It was very, very awful. So this issue is going to continue before the council.
And do we have any timeline on this one?
I know they have to balance their budget by June, so if they're going to try and get that revenue, they're probably going to have to take this up pretty soon. I don't know the exact date, though, for Bill 69.
All right, well, we'll be following it, and we'll talk more about it, no doubt. Thanks, Chad.
Okay, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about a poet and songwriter who wrote what became the first official anthem of the Hawaiian Kingdom, a song called He Mele Lahui Hawaii. It was her first published composition, written at the request of King Kamehameha V, published in 1867. It included the lines, "Forever be our country free, our laws and heavens in harmony," lines that took on an ironic meaning a few years later. The author went on to become one of the Hawaiian nation's most prolific and gifted songwriters, with words like Aloha Oi, a song that came to symbolize the loss of the monarchy. By now you will have guessed that the author of this early work was Lulia K. Dominus, as she was then known. She's remembered as Lulio o Kalani, the last reigning monarch of the Hawaiian kingdom. It's 8:42, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, with a Mother's Day concert featuring violinist Iggy Jang performing Paganini's La Campanella, 4 p.m. this Sunday. HawaiiSymphonyOrchestra.org.
It's time for Stargazer. Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is our weekly update of what's happening in our island skies and the world of astronomy. As usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips, Emilo Astronomy Center in Hilo, our official connection to the Mauna Kea Summit Research Community. Hey, aloha, Christopher. What are we going to be looking for in our week of stargazing?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. Both Mars and Jupiter will be shining brightly early in the evening sky. Jupiter to the west, Komohana. Mars to the east, Hikina. Rising around 7:30 p.m. in Hikina also will be Saturn.
And how will the moon affect our planetary viewing this week?
Well, it's pretty good. The moon is going to be in its crescent phase about halfway through the week, giving us nice dark island skies. Unfortunately, though, the normally bright International Space Station will be making its passes during the day, so we won't be able to see it this time around.
And this week, we thought that it would be appropriate to learn about alien stars via Christopher and some information he's got to share with us.
That's right, Dave. Well, talk of new planets out there and life-bearing environments in our own solar system have been all the rage here on Stargazer recently. But whilst we keep talking about planets and moons, we really should be also talking about stars. Now, this might seem like a no-brainer, but the star around which a planet orbits can make all the difference when it comes to making a place suitable for life. Too hot, and the planet gets fried like an egg. Too cold, and it freezes like a popsicle. But there's more to stars than just temperature. Stars are like people. They come in all shapes and sizes, and they have their own unique personalities. Our sun, for example, is kind of a nice guy. It's a very stable, yellow-white star that makes life here on Earth pretty sweet. However, the sun is just one example of a star. Some planets we've discovered out there exist around stars that from a distance look nice and stable. But up close, they have violent outbursts of behavior. They are unpredictable and deadly. During these temper tantrums, the stars throw out huge clouds of superheated gas. These outbursts can quite literally strip the atmosphere off a planet and barbecue the surface. Other stars don't throw out burning clouds, but instead emit high levels of radiation. Just imagine living inside your microwave, and that should give you an idea of what life is like around some of these stars.
The quality of the light that they emit, I imagine, can vary quite a bit from what we have.
Yeah, so some stars are very dim. So skies on those planets will be dark, like an overcast day here on Earth. Other stars will be super bright. So bright, in fact, you wouldn't be able to look at them.
Very informative. Appreciate it, Christopher. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
You are quite welcome. Christopher Phillips, Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next time here for Stargazer.
A quick program note, we were expecting to talk to marine biologist Terry Lilly about the coral reef on Kauai. We're going to bring him back on a later show. We had some issues with the phone line. But on to Maui, and Hawaii's Portuguese population began its large-scale immigration to our islands in much the same way the first settlers came to the U.S. mainland, leaving behind a world that could not support them, looking for new opportunities. In their second century here, Hawaii's Portuguese continued to keep their traditions alive through such organizations as the Maui Portuguese Cultural Club, which is holding a festa next Saturday. Laura Peressa is a longtime member of the club. She's on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. Bon dia.
A lot of you in the club have family memories, right?
Yes.
What are some of yours?
Some of mine are being with my grandmother and learning how to cook traditional Portuguese foods. I've been to festas and saw the chamarita, which is a Portuguese traditional dance.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother used to bake what's called the folar de Pascua, which is the Easter bread, the sweet bread.
Uh-huh.
As we know it in Hawaii, but there would be an egg in the middle and a cross over the egg to hold it in place, and we'd have that every year.
Wow. What a lovely tradition.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the others that you remember?
Well, we would make what's called a lapinha. A lapinha is seven layers of shelves, a display, if you will, of all the saints and in the world who have done good for the church and for God. And seven is representing the 7 days of creation, where the top layer would have God. In the beginning was the Word, so God would be up there. And then he made the stars the next day and the heavens, and each layer represents something. And Then we also put out wheatgrass, little bowls of wheatgrass, to symbolize Christ in the form of bread. So all of our customs are pretty much tied to the church. So the lapinha is one of them. I remember learning so many superstitions, that you can't put the broom a certain way because you'll be inviting witches to come.
Really?
The fetzeres, yeah. And about cubrants, which are, you know, spells that can be cast, and basically how to protect yourself from envy, which is the biggest and meanest of all of the things that people can put on you, or a cubrant, where they are envious of you and they take away some of your spirit because of their envy. So we have multiple ways in which to protect ourselves from this. And I'm learning a lot more of them as time goes on.
Well, this is great stuff, Laura. Your voice is trailing off a little bit, so you need to just address the handset just a little bit, you know, get in close to it, because I'm losing the tail end of some of your sentences.
Okay.
But these are some lovely traditions through the family, and not all of them, as you say, there's some superstitions. What was that word for witches that you used?
Fetzera. Fetzera.
And how are they described?
Well, my grandmother always used to tell me that the fetzera is the first one in the church and the last one to leave. So you'd know who they were by that description. So I remember going to church and trying to see who was there before me to see who they were.
Some of these traditions remind me, there's the old, in some European country, the evil eye, does that come up in Portuguese culture?
Yes, exactly. And there's a way to protect yourself from the evil eye. So if anyone praises you immensely and has evil in their heart and they're giving you that evil eye, you're supposed to put your thumb underneath your index finger, mm-hmm. and that's supposed to protect you from the evil eye.
Oh, I thought it was a little bit different, the index finger and little finger extended. It's thumb and index finger.
That's Shaka.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, when I first saw Shaka, I was reminded of seeing, because I've seen the evil eye gesture in New York neighborhoods.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
But you ward it off, and sometimes praise can contain evil in that tradition.
Yes, because it's not clean coming from them. It's based on envy, and they don't want good things to happen to you.
So if you've had a great success and someone praises you with a degree of insincerity, that might merit warding that off, huh?
Yes. And you can put your thumb, cover your thumb with your index finger in an indiscreet way, and you'll still be protected from it.
Do you see old folks in the culture sort of unconsciously do that? I mean, is that pretty ingrained?
Yeah. We do see that. Most of the time, they're not, outward with it, but they do talk about it a lot. And being in the Maui Portuguese Cultural Club, I'm around the older population, and they tell stories about fetzeres and spells and all that kind of things. And I'm learning a lot through them because of what they're saying.
And I would think that some of these traditions, particularly the witches and the spells, that sounds very sort of 15th century European, you know. It goes back quite a ways, doesn't it?
Exactly. The Portuguese have a tradition where they will put a little group of rosemary or rue, a ruda, as they call it in Portugal, and wheat and poppies and olive branches and daisies, and they make this bundle and they put it on the door. And the rosemary is supposed to ward off evil, as well as the rue is supposed to ward off evil. The wheat symbolizes abundance, the poppies good health, the olive branches peace, and the daisies financial security. And all of this is put on your front door so that there's two things. It wards off evil, and it welcomes prosperity.
And these are very, they strike me, Laura, as very sort of pagan in an ancient kind of way. Celebrations of the harvest, warding off evil, promoting the, you know, a prosperous harvest. It goes really deep, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And it evolved even into the church. So even though Catholicism came along and changed many of the pagan ways, these traditions were superimposed into the Catholic Church and the festivals and feasts and traditions of the church. And it sort of went along with it, the abundance, the peace, the good health, you know, all of that was factored in when the church came. And so the church did with the Hawaiian people when they came to Hawaii. You know, the Hawaiian people loved to garden, and the first priests here loved to garden, and through this gardening they started a relationship. There are many traditions in Hawaiian culture that are part of the teachings of the church about love and family, and you know, so it was an easy progression into the Catholic faith here in Hawaii.
Well, Laura, it says a lot about the way populations that have, you know, traveled far from home, how those populations adapt, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. When the people came from the Azores and Madeira, which is the places that most of the ancestors of the Portuguese here in Hawaii today came from, they thought that the ship's captain had turned around and taken them back to the Azores and Madeira because they're island people. And,
yeah.
You know, it looked, they brought them to an island, and from a distance, you know, it looked just like the island that they left.
Thought he got totally mixed up. Laura, thanks so much for talking with us. It's really, those are great stories. Appreciate
well, you're
it.
Welcome.
Laura Peressa is a longtime member of the Maui Portuguese Cultural Club, which will be holding a Portuguese Festa, our cultural festival, on Saturday, May 10th at the Kaipanivai Park Portuguese Heritage Garden in Iao Valley. The Festa will begin at 10 a.m. with a Coronation of Mary ceremony in remembrance of her appearance to three children in Fatima, Portugal in 1917. Children and adults will then dance the Chamarita, the cultural dance of Portugal, and details are at hpr2.org.
Chamarita nova, esta nova chamarita, esta chamarita nova, ai esta nova chamarita, bem cantada e bem malhada, não há moda mais bonita, bem cantada e bem malhada, não há moda.
A lawyer uses zoning laws in upstate New York to take on the gas industry and fracking with a simple message.
There's no place in our community where this is appropriate, and you're not allowed to do this at all in our town. No fracking way.
Her initiative is winning and wins her the Goldman Prize. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
This afternoon at 4, right after Fresh Air.
Listening to your last conversation, I wanted her to go on and on with those stories.
Wasn't that fun?
Fun, but also illuminating and really reminiscent of the fact that there are so many of these similar type stories in so many cultures, but the way in which their evidence is slightly different.
Yeah, and it's great that you know, grandmothers keep alive traditions that take you back to another continent, another time, another century, and a very different way of life.
I want to know how you know the people who are wishing you ill all the while that they're telling
Everybody wants to
you're terrific. That. And I'm glad at least I've got the rosemary at my back door along with a couple of daisies. That's going to do it for us for the moment. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning with a check of mental illness in Hawaii, some changes and what family and friends may be able to do to help a loved one.
And a celebration of heritage in the Polk Keller Awards Book of the Year.
You can talk back to your radio, write to us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Tweet us at HI Conversation or get to me at BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear today's show again, you can get it at hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.